Blog Talk Radio.
People make the world go round.
Jordan, and you're on the Gist of Freedom show. Is this our guest, Jacob Morris?
It is.
How are you, Mr. Morris?
Oh, I'm good. Excellent.
Wonderful. It's an honor to have you with us on the last day of February in what we celebrate as Black History Month, although every day we should celebrate our history.
I truly agree.
As soon as you would like, I want you to share with us who you are and your organization and what exactly it is you do.
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. I'm the director of the Harlem Historical Society. And also another organization that we formed about a year ago called the Sugar Hill Luminaries Conservancy, which is the conservancy for a small park at the intersection of 155th Street and Edgecombe Avenue, right in the heart of Sugar Hill in Harlem, in New York City. And
okay, for those who are not familiar with the history of Sugar Hill, would you share how Sugar Hill actually received its name?
Oh. Well, you know, there's different stories about that, but really, the one I like the best has two aspects to it. One is, you see, there's this ridge this geological formation that runs down the spine, the center spine of Manhattan. And Sugar Hill is at the top of this ridge, and it basically looks like a hill if you're down in the valley of Harlem, which would be east of Edgecombe Avenue. Then there's this sharp drop down, especially north of about 135th Street.
Okay, so it's north of 135th.
And then going up.
All the way.
All the way up. Towards the George Washington Bridge. And of course the Harlem River cuts at an angle, separating Manhattan from the Bronx. So Manhattan gets a lot more narrow above. Well, it starts
Hello,
again.
Hello, Jacob. This is Leslie.
125th Street.
Okay.
And then it really gets very narrow up above, like, 155th.
Jacob.
Oh. Yes?
Can you hear
Hi.
Me? Leslie, how's everything?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
Good. Good. Why are you avoiding the question? Where did the name come from?
Well, I started talking about the geology of Manhattan.
Geographic.
But the other aspect, which would be, I guess, the more social and cultural and even economic, would be really that blacks gave Sugar Hill its nickname that stuck, which is that this is the part of Harlem where the blacks with the sugar lived.
Right, okay. And that's what...
And they would point up to the top of the hill, and they'd say, that's where the blacks live with the sugar.
Okay.
And
yeah.
That part of the story I really enjoy. And, and it was more than just that they had the money, or more money than the blacks down in the valley, so to speak. But it was also... the sweet life. You know, there was other things to life besides money that got respected, like arts and culture. And that meant music, and that meant the visual arts and just all sorts of aspects to our society, politics, even boxing and baseball players, they lived in Sugar Hill.
Okay.
In Sugar Hill, on Sugar Hill.
Is there a sign referencing Sugar Hill?
That's a good question. What happened was, politically, Sugar Hill kind of got artificially divided at 155th Street. This is my view. What you have is you have the different community boards that are like the grassroots level of local government in New York City. And you have Community Board 10, which is the community board for Central Harlem, and its northwesternmost point is in the middle of the intersection of Edgecombe and 155th. And then north of that, you have Community Board 12, to the west of that, you have Community Board 9. And so you have three community boards meeting, right there. But really, as a neighborhood, Sugar Hill pretty much extends up from, let's say... definitely from 145th Street north,
Okay.
So maybe about 165th Street.
Okay.
Along Edgecombe Avenue and a little to, you know, and then going over towards St. Nick's.
All righty. What I want to do is actually talk about what you do with the Harlem Historical Society, and that is, from what I'm aware of, working to establish or rename certain avenues with names of famous African Americans. Is that true?
Yep. Except I wouldn't call it renaming in New York City these days. Stuff doesn't get renamed, it gets co-named. So you wind up with two street signs on the
So it's not 7th Avenue anymore, it's 7th Avenue, and it's
co-named. And people kind of like that because and this is in just about any neighborhood in New York City, whether they're Dominican or Black or polka dot, they like to get their mail.
Okay.
Well, they don't like to get lost. So you got to keep the old signs. But you can put the new signs on, and that really can do amazing things in terms of raising the consciousness of our society as to the connections of place to what happened in these places and who lived in these places, various places. One of my overriding guidelines is that there be a geographic linkage between, let's say, the person or the movement and the place.
Right. So,
I really am guided by that in my work. And I tell people that history is local. And
so
that when you walk on the sidewalk, on the street where someone walked, like a W.E.B. Du Bois, or a Billie Holiday, or a Paul Robeson. I mean, you almost, if you're aware of it, you almost feel like you're walking in their steps, and it evokes feelings and emotions that are powerful and that promote a deeper understanding of how we came to be where we are now.
So are those people an example of someone you've worked on, not renaming, co-naming an avenue? Was it a Billie Holiday or?
Yes.
Okay. And
the short answer is yes.
Okay. Well, would you?
We've also done parts. We've also. Actually, I've gotten some parks renamed, because the regulations are different for parks than they are for streets. So I got a playground renamed after Althea Gibson.
Okay.
And the park at the intersection of 155th and Edgecombe, we got renamed Sugar Hill Luminary's Lawn, which is kind of nice.
Okay,
what is
Abolitionist Way?
That's a street. That's a co-naming of a street in Brooklyn, and it's Abolitionist Place.
Okay.
That's just off of Fulton Street in downtown Brooklyn, and on a two-block stretch of Duffield Street, there was this incredible concentration of very active abolitionists before the Civil War. And, so I identified this cluster of abolitionists, and then I moved to, get the street co-named Abolitionist Place, and we were successful. And it literally, it was funny, while you're doing it, it was very hard. But then after it was done, then everybody jumped on it. And and became extremely proud of Brooklyn's role in the abolitionist movement. I found that to be a great big tickle. But, you know, it was nice, too. again, you know, it actually forced the Economic Development Corporation of New York City to change the master plan for the downtown Metrotech Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn Metrotech expansion, which was like more than $1.5 billion project. It forced them to change the plans because there was houses there that actually were safe havens and transit points for freedom seekers escaping slavery. But the way they had the game set up was that they were making the people on the block who were protesting the demolition of their houses for a great big parking garage, as a matter of fact. And so, you know, they came to me because I wrote the grant for the New York Historical Society for the Underground Railroad. That was the first federal grant that for the Slavery in New York exhibit, which was a great exhibit.
Right.
Now, was that part of the eminent domain?
I found this grant, and I brought it to them, and they won it, which was nice, and that helped establish my credibility as someone very knowledgeable about New York City's role in the Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement.
Now, Jacob.
So they asked
for
my help. Yes.
Okay. Can you tell us about the different people that lived on that block?
Abolitionists. Well, actually, one of them was William Still's brother.
All right. That's awesome.
Yeah, but I mean, there was about
that fact?
Including even Walt Whitman lived on that block when he was an editor for the Brooklyn Express, which was really, really cool. And he got fired by the Brooklyn Express because he was too pro-abolitionist.
Wow.
Yeah,
now,
that was around
48. How did you uncover all this information?
48.
How did you find it? How did you find this information out?
I read a lot. No, I really do. I read. I go to primary documents. If I'm really like into, you know, understanding a subject, then I just really get into it and I just read everything I can find, and I talk to people and then I read some more and I just follow the trail of knowledge, but. You know,
you
the most important thing about the way that was framed was, and that's what I was trying to communicate a little earlier in response to an earlier question of yours, was that, you see, the Economic Development Corporation had set up the game, so to speak, that they were forcing the local residents who were protesting the demolition of their houses to prove almost beyond a shadow of a doubt the connection between Underground Railroad activity and their houses. And when they brought me in to help them fight this, after I got into it, almost right away, and I went down to the basement and I saw where they hid the escaping slaves. And it was really incredible. And I said, you're not going to win this playing their game. I said, even if you found a skeleton down here in this sub-basement, with iron manacles around the bones, they would say that wasn't definitive proof. Because it was, you know, this real estate steamroller. And so I said, resistance to slavery is reason enough to preserve.
Right.
And so I said, if we show that just documented abolitionists lived up and down this street, that alone will be reason enough to preserve. Not definitive proof of Underground Railroad activity. And then once I was able to show that really more than 20 well-documented abolitionist families lived up and down, owned property up and down Duffield Street in Brooklyn, it became so obvious that, of course, there was Underground Railroad activity, but we didn't need to prove it. Just the knowledge, definitive knowledge of that they were very active abolitionists was enough.
I have a quick question. Was this
sure.
Was this an integrated block? Was it just?
Yes, absolutely. Think about it. Of course, it was integrated. Walt Whitman was white.
Right, exactly. That's what I, yeah.
Go ahead.
I took the word
we all live on the same block.
And William Still's brother was black. And that's only an example. Yes, absolutely, it was integrated.
Now, I know you have a desire to have a trail similar to the trail in Boston. Could you explain to the audience more about this trail that you want to have in New York City?
Yeah, actually, you know, that's very interesting. Now, I've had this idea for a long time. As a matter of fact, when I first proposed Frederick Douglass Landing, that was the first street that I ever got approved. I had to teach myself how to do that. You know, it's not something you learn in school. But, you know, I felt very, very invested by the time I came to that that feeling that I had to do something to bring out the story of New York City's role in the Underground Railroad movement and as an Underground Railroad nexus of activity, a major, major, major nexus of Underground Railroad activity. You know, and I would say things like, the Underground Railroad's so well documented in Philadelphia, and it's so well documented in Boston, but it's not documented hardly at all in New York City. What did they do? Take a helicopter? You know, what did they do? Fly over New York City? So I came up with a couple of very basic insights. One was that water was a highway. It wasn't a barrier before
right.
the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this was like 10 years ago. So when I... And then I found this Underground Railroad grant, and I was trying to win it for about three and a half years for this friend of mine who's a history professor in Brooklyn at Medgevers College. And I wanted to bring some money to his nonprofit because, you know, he's just like
what
a wonderful
do with the money?
And he does wonderful work, and I wanted to, you know, help him. But, you know, somehow we never quite got the application in on time, partially, I believe, because
what was the application?
My friend didn't think we could win it, you know. So at that point, I was speaking with the people in Washington who direct the grant money, and they told me that it looked like the Bush administration. Now, this was in the middle of the Iraq War. Yes. Yes.
The Freedom Trail in Boston.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a second.
Oh, we only have 10 minutes left.
Yeah. Just stay with me for a second.
I don't know.
So when the when I was told that the Bush administration was going to cut the funding to the grant, I was very, very upset. And then I was like, well, the hell with the money. The story is more important than the money. So how do you tell the story without money? And that's when I came up with the idea of naming the west part of Chambers Street after Frederick Douglass. And so that became like the first location on this Freedom Trail idea.
Okay.
So that was the genesis of the downtown Freedom Trail idea.
Can you describe the Freedom Trail in Boston?
Well, you see, in downtown Manhattan was basically Tribeca, what is currently known as Tribeca, the triangle below Canal Street, was really New York City's Harlem before the Civil War. And it was honeycombed with Underground Railroad sites, sanctuaries, black churches, black doctors, black pharmacies, black abolitionists. You see, in New York City, the abolitionist movement was really controlled by black abolitionists. And I believe that that's why it's not really in the history books. And I was kind of shocked by that. You know, I said to myself and to other people, after I said it to myself first, I said, gee, this is the good part of the story. Why ain't this in the history books? It should be. And it's something that New York City can be proud of.
Jacob, for people who are interested in your story and want to learn more about these black abolitionists, do you have any books you could recommend for us to read?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, you know, the first book that I read on black abolitionists is called Black Abolitionists. It's by a great black history scholar, Benjamin Quarles. Excellent, really, really excellent. There's a more recent book that's really very, very good. It's called Bound for Canaan. I can highly recommend that. You know, doing that whole thing with downtown Manhattan, where my work started, I became aware of David Ruggles, and really, David Ruggles was like a role model for Frederick Douglass. And he established the first black reading room. He was the first black magazine publisher in the United States. And his boarding house, these were locations all on Lispinard Street, which is close to Chambers. It was in his boarding house that that Frederick Douglass was married to Anne Murray.
Okay.
By the Reverend James Pennington, who was also another leader of the Underground Railroad in New York City. And, this was a great way to bring out the story. And
Louis Tappan?
I'm sorry?
Who was Louis Tappan, T-A-P-P-A-N?
That was the Tappan brothers, and they were rich. And they were abolitionists. They were white. And they helped support the blacks who ran the abolitionist movement in New York City. This was one of the things that that really profoundly moved me about the way things were before the Civil War in New York City with the abolitionist movement was you know what they established in 1835?
No.
It was called the Vigilance Committee. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, why did they call it a Vigilance Committee? And when you look at the founding documents of this organization, this Vigilance Committee, their first priority was to look out for their children who were getting kidnapped by bounty hunters who would take the children and sell them back into slavery. And their second priority was to help freedom-seeking blacks who were looking to escape slavery and coming across the Hudson River. But their first priority was to look out, to be vigilant for their own children who were getting kidnapped.
Wow.
Let me ask you this, if I may, and that is for someone who has an interest in co-naming a street, what would you suggest they do?
Well, that's a great question. Oh, golly. Let's see. Well, it depends on where they're located. So, you know, what they need to do is they need to be acquainted with the local political structure. And who has jurisdiction. And then they need to know their history of whoever it is that they want to present on and want to honor. Who or what, you know, whether it's a movement or a person. Now, you know, in New York City, as it turned out, you know, when I started, I thought jurisdiction lay in the city council. And ultimately it does. But overwhelmingly, city council people will not approve, will not bring a co-naming proposal up for a vote before the council unless it's fully vetted and approved by resolution by a community board. So in this particular area, community boards have more, quotation marks, power than people think they do. Just worked out that way, you know. So this understanding that I developed about the way things work, I use. You know, so I was able to make that work in Brooklyn with Abolitionist Place. And, you know, once the community board approved Abolitionist Place, it just, like, freaked out very high levels of the government of New York City. And then they had to act nice, you know, and say, well, of course we support commemorating and honoring the abolitionist movement. Before that, they were dead set against it because it was messing with their mega real estate project.
Okay. Yeah. So whatever is involved.
So, you know, the local can influence, you know, the larger political entities, you know, maybe in other states and, you know, it can influence whole counties. It, you know, it depends on the structure. Maybe there's a board of trustees. Maybe there's a... you know, a village this or a town that.
I'm glad you mentioned village because I just learned something this week while attending an event. A lady got up and spoke about Seneca Village.
Ah, yes, in Central Park.
Right.
Right.
Tell a story about Seneca Village, please.
Seneca Village was basically a real honest-to-goodness village, mostly of blacks, in the middle of Central Park in Manhattan before the Civil War. And then when they came up with the idea of doing Central Park, they just moved them out. And it was a real functioning little village, you know, with churches and I think even a burial ground. And some great work has been done by you know, local researchers to reestablish where it was. But a lot more can be done.
So are there any monuments to commemorate the place?
There's a little, there's some signage lately about it.
Yeah.
And there's stuff on the New York Historical Society website relating to Seneca Village and some of the archaeological work that's been done to unearth the dimensions of the village and how they lived. And
but anything in the park right now that we can touch, anything?
Isn't there,
I believe there is. I don't know exactly.
What is it, Yvette?
There's a plaque, I believe, in the area of 86th Street, somewhere in that area, where it actually shows
location of the village.
Right, exactly. And then there are also some stones in the ground overgrown with weeds that also show where Seneca Village was. But in terms of any actual structures, anything standing, all of that is gone. It's really, really sad.
Oh, yeah, all gone. All
any
gone.
Any descendants around? Anybody talk to any descendants or any type of documentation?
They've been scattered pretty much.
Well, there's no Seneca group or anything like that?
There's people that are interested in the subject, but... Nothing.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I don't believe there's an organized group.
Do you think it's worthy of a sign?
Oh, absolutely. And more than a sign.
So if we have some Seneca Jewish descendants listening to the show right now, what would they have to do to get a sign, you know?
Well, it's more than, I mean, just the sign wouldn't be enough in my view.
Right.
But
it's a start,
no,
right?
When you start looking at the story, you can learn so much about not only Seneca Village itself, but about how it got wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so then you can learn a lot about how New York City government worked and how they went about even planning Central Park as part of the city. You know, because really, you know, New York City... north of, let's say, 57th Street at that point in time when they started to come up with the real plans to do a Central Park.
Now, do you know the story behind Wall Street, the name?
I'm sorry. Oh, Wall Street. Wall Street was a wall. To protect New Amsterdam from the Indians, and Wall Street was basically built by slave labor.
So it was a physical wall.
It was a physical wall of logs.
And what was its purpose?
To protect New Amsterdam from the Indians. And you know, and another cool thing about that, well, you know, semi cool. If you like history and you think things about history are cool, which I do, is that the Dutch gave farms north of the wall to black people with the explicit reason that they would be the buffer between the Indians and the whites. Their farms, the black people's farms.
So they didn't want any commingling?
No, I wouldn't say that. There was definitely commingling.
So
but it was, you know, it was more like, I'll buy food from you kind of commingling.
But so why would they need a buffer? I'm lost. Why would they need a buffer if they didn't want...
Because north of the wall was the Indians.
They didn't want to be around the Indians?
The wall was New Amsterdam, which was the little city of New Amsterdam. which had other people in it, Dutch and English, but mostly Dutch. And, you know, they were afraid of attacks by the Indians.
That's fascinating.
And so, you know, what was it? I guess they found that, you know, two things, I suppose. One is that black people maybe got along with the Indians better than white people did. And the other was that black people were maybe more expendable than white people. You know, it's only funny in retrospect. It's more of a cynical funny, if you know what I mean.
Now, is there any reference to this story anywhere near Wall Street?
Of course. Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
You know, any good history of New York City has this stuff.
But there aren't any monuments or anything on Wall Street.
No.
There's nothing to tell you that Wall Street's name originated based
with
on
a wall?
The story you just told. Yeah, with a wall.
No, there's nothing. There's nothing up now that says, "Oh, Wall Street was built by black slaves." No.
So that's another example of a co-naming.
Also, the road from New Amsterdam to New Harlem, which was this little farming village where Harlem is today. It's where Harlem got its name, New Harlem. Harlem is a city in Holland.
Mm.
Think about it. So, New Harlem, New Amsterdam.
Now, what is the significance
of Old Harlem and Old Amsterdam?
Can you tell us a little bit about Alexander Hamilton's connection? And if
there's a
street named after him?
Oh, that goes back to the old Sugar Hill thing.
Well, we're going to start and where we began. Go ahead.
So what happened was you were talking about the districts, or you asked a question about the districts. And you were asking about signage for Sugar Hill. And that's so funny. So the way the City Planning Commission, you know, it's really, I mean,
we have 3 minutes left.
All these different governmental entities that have jurisdiction over how things get named and delineated. So they came up with, in response to pressure from the people in the neighborhood over there, they came up with what they called a combined historic district designation. And, you know, and to get designated a historic district has certain criteria. And the name that they came up with was a combination of Hamilton Heights and Sugar Hill. And so they named it the Hamilton Heights Sugar Hill Historic District. And the northernmost boundary of this combined district is 155th Street. And quite a few people, including myself, feel that these are really two different neighborhoods that got squished together by this artificial designation by the City Planning Commission. But Hamilton Heights, of course, again, it's on the heights, so it's up on that ridge, that geologic formation. That's a little bit west of Edgecombe Avenue.
And why did they move Hamilton's house?
'Cause it was squished in to this little plot of land, and you couldn't really see it. But, you know, so where they moved it to, I mean, I like where they moved it to. You know, now you can, you know, I think it, you know, it was quite an engineering feat to move that house.
I was there.
Around the corner.
Yeah.
I was there.
Roll
I,
it down the car. I mean, it was really an incredible accomplishment.
Now, what is what is Alexander Hamilton's role as an abolitionist in the African Free School?
Ah, well, no, that's pretty cool, actually. He and John Jay were the founders of the Manumission Society.
And what does that mean?
In the late 1790s, which is, shortly after the establishment of the government of the United States. And they formed the Manumission Society. And the Manumission Society then sponsored the first African Free School.
For those who don't know what manumission means, can you explain?
It called for the freeing of blacks. Manumission being to, basically buy their freedom.
Okay. Well, that is the end of our show. Do you want to give a piece of advice before you leave?
Sure. Know your history, and then don't think that you can't make a difference. And don't depend on they to do stuff for you. You can do it yourself. You can make a difference in this world.
That's great advice.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Yvette, so much. He was hard. He was difficult, but we handled him. Didn't we, Yvette?
I totally
thank
agree.
You're a lot of work. But, Jacob, I will be talking to you soon. Yvette, thank you so much for hosting the show tonight. And we'll talk again on Sunday.
And both you ladies are wonderful, wonderful ladies.
Yeah, that's Yvette Jordan you're speaking to, the history teacher from Newark, New Jersey. And we'll talk
soon. Truly a pleasure.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.